Today's lesson is iFaith 31, Heroes and Zeros. Or if you want a subtitle, we could call it Nimrod, the Nephilim, and Noah. Recently, I was in America's capital city, Washington, D.C., with my daughter, and we were in the Portrait Gallery. The National Portrait Gallery has a section on the presidents. And one thing I noticed as I looked at these impressive pictures, and as I looked them up on Wikipedia to make sure I had the right details, notice that they're all pretty tall. People who get elected to many positions in the world are people who are larger, taller than others. Usually the criterion is outward. It's the appearance or it's the personality. Now, this is not to say that all tall people lack character, because I think there's some presidents who had great character, just as there are many leaders and athletes who are big or tall with good character, but they don't always go together. We think of the NBA, MLB, NFL. We know that sports can build character, but often fails to do so when there's sin. Or think of the military, where we consider heroes, those who deliver us. Well, our focus today, again, heroes, Noah, Nimrod, Nephilim, and it's from Genesis. In fact, the material I'm sharing is in our new book called Origins. And Origins is on the first 11 chapters of Genesis. We learn the truth about the Tower of Babel, about the giants, the origins of technology, the creation story, the flood story, the quest for immortality. And we see that many of these stories, actually everything, is already familiar to the people in that part of the world. But the Bible has rewritten it. It's rewritten their flood story. It's rewritten their creation story to give glory to God. All the gods are removed. Now there's only one God. And God does not create us to be his slaves, but for relationship, for partnership. But that's the book. I hope you'll check it out. In short, there are two kinds of hero. There's the worldly kind and the godly kind. And modern culture celebrates and even idolizes sports stars, military commanders, Hollywood starlets, billionaires. And the ancient world was pretty similar, had the same basic broad categories. Think of gladiators, generals, actors in theater, chariot drivers, aristocrats. We're really no different. That ancient world is long ago, but we are really no different to them, are we? So, let me give you a couple examples, and then we'll get into the Bible. And one example is, of course, Homer, the ancient Greek who spoke of Ajax and Achilles and Odysseus. The Vikings had their heroes, Sigmund, Guthmundur, Ragnar Lothbrok. In the Viking mythology, the idea of heaven is that you're in a banqueting hall, Valhalla, and that's where you celebrate your victories. And each day you go out and you kill the enemies and you win glory, and then you come back to the banqueting hall that evening and eat and boast and brag and get drunk, maybe get into some brawls, and you sleep, and the next day you go out to battle again, over and over and over, winning glory. That's very worldly. That's not the way the Bible speaks of heroism. One of the great heroes or champions of the Bible is Goliath, the Philistine, who was very tall. But tall people are not always spiritual people. Right now, I'm in the end of 1 Samuel. Saul is going to die soon. King Saul was much taller, this taller, a head taller than everybody else. Tall doesn't mean that you are godly. So who do we praise? And do we understand heroism correctly? And I will say this, I don't mean to generalize too much, but I would say that most Christians have a worldly idea of what it is to be a hero, even of what it means to be a hero in God's kingdom. Heroic men and women are those who obey God. And frequently, they are called to reject what is celebrated by society. And frequently, they're not even recognized as heroes. Genesis 6:1. When people began to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that they were fair, and they took wives for themselves of all that they chose. And then Yahweh said, My spirit shall not abide in mortals forever, for they are flesh. Their days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of humans who bore children to them. These were the heroes of old, warriors of renown. Okay, that's the first half of our passage. We'll read the next four verses in just a moment. So we read of some pretty odd things happening here. Human population is increasing, and the sons of God, normally considered to be angels, lust after the daughters of men. Reminds me of a Greek myth where Jupiter, the king of the gods, is in love with a mortal woman, and so he turns himself into a swan, and that way doesn't scare her away, and she gets pregnant, I think, and crazy stuff like that. You say, why would us immortals lust after mortals? That doesn't even make sense. But it's outward appearance. And it says that the people, the sons of God, let me read this correctly. The sons of God saw that these women were beautiful. They saw. Now, that was the first step in the sin of Adam and Eve. Genesis 3:6. They saw that the fruit was good, right? And Achan in Joshua 7. He's led by his eyes. Even David, 2 Samuel 11, he sees Bathsheba. We know what happens. And when we are led by our eyes, bad things happen. So human beings are being fruitful. They're multiplying. They're obeying that command. But the sons of God, these angels, are crossing a barrier. They're having relations with women, and this is displeasing to God. But the offspring of these unions are the Nephilim. And as we're going to see, Genesis is saying, in effect, well, so what if there was a superior race of giants, great heroes, fallen angels mating with humans? Real heroes are godly, like Noah. Now, in the ancient religions, again, various divinities mate with humans. Hercules would be one of those. He's the son of Zeus by Alcmene. Perseus, who's very popular today in movies, he was the son of Zeus by Danae. The Genesis writer is tapping into a familiar tradition in the ancient world. And the offspring in Genesis 6 are Nephilim. Now, in Hebrew, Nephilim means fallen ones. And they are fallen from grace, for sure. The writer says they were heroes of old, warriors of renown. But the Jews understood them to be giants. And in the Greek Old Testament, which I'm studying right now, it doesn't say Nephilim. It just says gigantes. These are giants. So they may have been well-known, honored among men, powerful, impressive, but they're fallen from grace. Now, like Cain, they seek a name of their own. They're warriors of renown. They're warriors of a name. And what does that name mean? That is talking about reputation. Cain named a city after himself. In Babel, Genesis 11, the people seek a name for themselves. In contrast, if we're following Yahweh, we seek His honor and glory. It's His name. And if we want to become truly great, it's the Lord who brings this about, as He did in the life of Abraham. He told Abraham, I will make your name great. So it's not good when we seek our own reputation. Once again, my friends, two kinds of heroes, worldly and godly. Verse 5. Yahweh saw the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and every inclination of the thoughts of their heart was evil, only evil, continually. Yahweh was sorry He had made humankind on earth. He grieved Him to His heart. So Yahweh said, I will blot out the earth from the earth the human beings I've created, people together with animals, creeping things, birds of the air, for I'm sorry I've made them. But Noah found favor in the sight of Yahweh. And that's where we end our study of the scripture. So there are all these worldly examples of people in early Genesis. It starts out well, it gets corrupt, and by when you get into chapter 4, chapter 6, it's getting pretty bad. There's an epidemic of sin and selfishness. And mankind is past the tipping point. Yahweh is grieved. He's saddened. And so He'll start over. And who will be the one He'll use to relaunch the human race? It's Noah. He's the man who has not corrupted himself. He's a true hero by virtue of walking with God. He obeys God, and he fears God more than he fears the judgment of his fellows. This is quite amazing because Noah actually says nothing. We never even hear him talking until after the flood, when he has a very small part. He doesn't vanquish foes. He doesn't, he doesn't have some incredible athletic records. He's not, we don't even know what he looks like, but we know that he obeys God. So he has that kind of stature. Now, I mentioned Nimrod. Very little to say about Nimrod. We're leaving the Nephilim for a moment. The ancient world, again, glorified those who lived large as warriors, hunters, and rulers. And in Genesis 10, we read, this is all we read about Nimrod. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Whatever that means, whoever he was, that's all we have left. In Hebrew, it may mean he shall rebel. We shall rebel. He was no pushover. No one told him what to do. So different from Noah. Noah's not a hero like them. He's not lucky, super strong, super intelligent. He doesn't rally the troops, slay the foe. But the narrative of Genesis shows us how he is truly heroic. And in contrast to the issue of the godly, ungodly marriages in Genesis 6, Noah and his sons all just have one wife, a human wife. So by the same token, we see a godly hero may be a zero in the world's eyes. Fortunately, God doesn't require us to be tall, strong, photogenic, or powerful. See, the pagan world exalted worldly people. The Bible inverts this. It turns it around. The ancient myths speak of angels and gods mating and producing giants of exceptional skill and strength. And Genesis says, so what? Because God defines greatness differently than we do. A humble heart and obedient spirit are of true worth in God's sight. Greatness is not physical. David was the great one, not Goliath. And Jesus repeatedly encourages us not to seek human approval or glory. Many verses in John, for example, say that. So getting in line with God's will may confuse others. They may make fun of us. Yet standing up for the truth, regardless of how outnumbered we are, how outclassed we are, that makes us heroes in the sight of the one, the only one, in fact, whose opinion counts. Heroism is obedience. It's not showy. Now, this has applications for leadership, for politics, for sports, for character. Leadership selection should not be based on personality or looks. A leader after God's heart is not loud, pushy. He's not a bully, not weak in character. And when will we learn? Don't put people in leadership who lack character hoping it will develop. It should be their first. And this should challenge us in our own hero worship. Do we idolize people? Are we overawed by those who are strong in academics or acting or athletics or any other area when they're not living for God? And has anyone, after all, been more impressive than Jesus Christ? More impressive of our adoration? He's the true hero. So to be Christians, to be God's people, we're going against the culture. We're being countercultural. Noah found favor with Yahweh. It says he was blameless. He exhibits a quality vital not only for overseers, church leaders, but for anyone who loves God. And let us strive to do the same. Heroes or zeros? Which are we? To be a hero in God's eyes may well mean that we're zeros in the world's eyes. Because in God's kingdom, values are upside down. I hope that's helpful for you. Hope it will help to change what we think about what is heroic. It's about obedience. It's not pushy. It's not flashy. It's not showy. It doesn't seek its own attention and reputation. It only cares about God. So that's my lesson, Nimrod and the Nephilim and Noah. Let's make the application. And I hope you're looking forward to the second video sermon from Genesis. That'll be number 32. Thank you for listening to this one. Don't be a zero. Be a hero, but God's way. God bless. Thank you.